Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Parent Trap, How to Stop Overloading Parents and Fix Our Inequality Crisis, by Nate G. Hilger, narrated by Will Tulin. Publisher's Note: This audiobook will refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction. Over the past 20 years, many industries have spent a great deal of money on lobbying to support their economic interests. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce spent $1.5 billion to support business interests. Unions spent $700 million to back labor interests. Real estate, health, pharmaceutical, aviation, and petroleum companies together spent more than $3 billion. The American Association of Retired People, AARP, spent $300 million to support elderly people's interests. There is one major industry that is not on this list. By many measures, it is the largest industry in the country. Given its failure to lobby, the industry receives little political support. Its many workers toil in isolation without recognition or compensation. Their backbreaking labor is not counted in any official statistics, as if it were secret or illegitimate. The industry has no centralized organization representing its interests. Relative to its size, it spends almost nothing on research and development to improve operations over time. The industry shuffles along at a fraction of its potential capacity, its participants underutilized, inefficient, overwhelmed. What is this monumental ghost industry? Parenting. The Two Sides of Parenting. We don't often think of parenting as an industry, or of parents as workers, and for good reason. Parents volunteer for the job, they want to do it, and they're more than happy to do it for free. In many ways, parenting is no more a job than loving or living. But just because love moves people to do a job for free doesn't mean their work isn't producing something of enormous cultural and economic value. And it is production of that value that can usefully be thought of, in some respects, as a major industry. Every year, American parents provide full-time, overtime, comprehensive child development services to America's 74 million children. If we value these services at market rate, what would it take to buy the most comparable services we can find for money? They sum to more than $5 trillion of output every year. Valued in this way, parenting emerges as the largest industry in the United States, easily beating out health care in second place at less than $4 trillion. So let's step back for a moment and see what happens if we view parents as members of a very important industry. In this capacity, parents have two main kinds of responsibilities. One of these responsibilities is to care for children. Caring is the more personal side of parenting. In this role, parents do their best to love children, protect them, provide for them, bring them joy, and comfort them against life's many slings and arrows. In their caring role, parents also pass along cherished cultural practices, rituals, and faiths to enrich their children's lives. The second responsibility of parents is to build skills in children. This is the more professional side of parenting. In this role, parents manage complex investments in all aspects of children's skill growth. Skills go far beyond book smarts, such as math and reading. They include general skills such as strength and dexterity, confidence and wit, tenacity and discipline. They also include more specific skills, such as how to play football or tennis, chess or guitar, how to fix a flat tire or build a campfire. These and so many other skills equip children to flourish independently in adulthood. As a form of wealth, skills are assets. All assets yield a flow of economic value to their owners over time. Stocks, for example, yield dividends and capital gains. Real estate yields rents. Cars yield transportation services. Skills yield value in the form of higher income, career satisfaction, health, and fun. Despite their diversity, all skills have some key things in common that distinguish them from other kinds of assets. Perhaps the most important and strange feature of skills is that they are taught and learned, rather than bought and sold instantaneously at a fixed price. Learning a skill is a messy process, involving different combinations of time, effort, and psychological friction for each individual person. Compare skills to other kinds of assets, like stocks. Anyone can buy a share of Google stock at the going rate, as of now, $2,349 per share, off the New York Stock Exchange and start earning dividends and capital gains right away. Same for automobiles. Anyone can buy a new base model Ford Explorer for about $33,000 and start driving it right away. You get the vehicle fully formed from a dealership, which in turn buys it from a factory that makes thousands of Explorers every year. Skills don't work anything like this. There is no base model of literacy or tenacity or guitar skills you can buy at a going rate from a dealership or an exchange. To acquire these skills, you have to find a teacher or a community or a manual, and you have to study, observe, struggle, and practice, all while wondering anxiously if slow progress is normal or troubling, and whether the opaque rewards will justify the unpredictable costs. Because skills are taught and learned rather than bought and sold, their acquisition is much more complex and prone to mistakes than the acquisition of other assets. Throughout history, we have tended to combine the two activities of caring and skill building into one word, parenting. But in reality, due to the unusual nature of skills, caring and skill building are as different as night and day. Caring is egalitarian, in that most people can do it successfully. That's not to say we can take it for granted. Some parents abuse or neglect their kids in terrible ways. An online group called Raised by Narcissists has more than 600,000 members. Literature is replete with uncaring parents, from Macbeth to Matilda. But most parents do grow into the caring role of parenthood. Many parents, moved by sheer love, develop a certain type of genius when it comes to caring about children. Building skills, in contrast, is not egalitarian. It is not widely accessible to all parents. Many parents who become experts in the caring department never quite master skill development. Does hearing that make you anxious? Am I accusing some parents of failure, of inferiority? No, but it's easy to see why you might feel that way. We've been programmed to believe that any parents who love their children also have what it takes to build skills, and anyone who says otherwise must be questioning that love. I call this bait and switch the parent trap, because it helps to trap parents in a system that guarantees many of them will fail at preparing their children for success in adulthood. Why does the parent trap persist? Because it has served to protect and legitimize all our society's deepest power hierarchies for generations. Rich and white people's success has had to reflect their superiority, not their greater access to elite skill-building resources in childhood. Women's historical exclusion from professions outside child development has had to reflect male superiority. Therefore, child development has had to be deemed simple and instinctual. In this book, I focus on America today, at a time when certain kinds of skills have been rising in value for decades. But in fact, the delegation of child skill growth to parents, isolated individuals often preoccupied with survival and ill-equipped to build complex skills, has fueled and rationalized inequality around the world for thousands of years. As the psychologist George Stoddard once wrote, "The chief advantage of kings is not in their lineage. It is in the power, often neglected, to establish from birth upwards the right kind of protection and education." Different skills have brought greater opportunity and wealth throughout history, but their development has been assigned to parents and thereby tacitly reserved for elites. From obtaining literacy and numeracy in medieval Europe to preparing for the National Civil Service exam in Imperial China, to building physical and mental strength in feudal societies, some version of this pattern has always applied. When you feel yourself reacting emotionally to the idea that many kinds of skill building are not accessible to most parents, you are channeling centuries of turmoil and exploitation. You may even sense a glimmer of shame. Shame about your own parenting, or shame about feeling arrogant or judgmental toward other parents. This shame is how mythologies survive. Our language itself is part of the trick. The trick is to define one word, parenting, to convey two glaringly different concepts, caring and skill building. That way, if we question equal access to one aspect of parenting, we can be accused of questioning equal access to the other. We can be accused of suggesting that many parents don't care about their children. That is the parent trap. In this book, we'll learn how to recognize, avoid, and solve the parent trap. We'll transform that anxiety you're feeling into political energy, inspired by hope that an alternate, better reality is possible. The truth is that parents can and should be primarily responsible for caring about children. And that's it. The power of skills. How we manage skill growth matters because skills are the bedrock of our economy. In 2020, the U.S. economy produced about $20 trillion worth of goods and services. That's everything from soybeans and cell phones to surgeries and surfing lessons. Where does all this valuable stuff come from? Some of it comes from harnessing capital, such as land, buildings, and machines. But most of it comes from labor, or human skill, probably about two-thirds of it, or $14 trillion every year. Skills drive overall income, but they also drive inequality in that income, alongside other factors including luck, social connections, preferences, and a wide range of institutions and policies, from labor unions to minimum wages. In particular, skills play a central role in two of the most worrisome kinds of inequality, the one emerging for children of different classes and the one emerging for children of different races. Today in America, a child raised by the top 25% richest parents will wind up earning about $50,000 more per year than a child raised by the bottom 25% poorest parents. Over a lifetime, this rich kid advantage is like inheriting a trust fund at age 18, worth nearly $1 million. Black-white income gaps are almost as large, at $36,000 per year. How important are skills as opposed to other factors, such as labor market discrimination and social connections, in driving these gaps by class and race? One way to answer this question is to compare the incomes of kids from different classes and races who wind up accumulating similar skills in childhood. Skills, of course, are hard to measure. One very limited measure is the Armed Forces Qualifying Test, AFQT, which is similar to an IQ test. These kinds of tests measure a narrow subset of skills often referred to as cognitive skills, such as basic math, reading comprehension, and pattern recognition. They make no attempt to measure behavioral skills such as self-control, social skills such as confidence, or emotional skills such as resilience. But if rich and poor kids perform equally well on just this one measure of cognitive skill as teenagers, 70% of their future income gap disappears. The rich kid still winds up a bit richer, but then again, the AFQT doesn't capture all of the rich kid's skill advantages. As we might expect, AFQT scores account for a smaller share of the black-white income gap, about 50% instead of 70%. That is still a lot of racial income inequality to explain with skills captured by one little test, but it's consistent with evidence that discrimination remains a powerful force in American society. Discrimination includes daily insults, such as extra scrutiny while shopping in stores and longer wait times at crosswalks, as well as major setbacks in employment, health care, criminal justice, and so many other systems we all rely on to build economic success. And, as we will see, long-term discrimination has also made it harder for people of color to acquire skills. The AFQT captures something important, but it's just one little test score and cannot possibly capture the full contribution of skill inequality to economic inequality. One way to capture a broader set of skills is to look at whether people attend college and the type of college they attend. Attending a better college has typically required not just higher scores on tests such as the SAT and ACT that are similar to the AFQT, but also better grades, teacher recommendations, application essays, and experience in extracurricular pursuits such as sports, music, and activism. Beyond the skills required for admission, better colleges also build additional skills through access to richer educational resources. One useful way to assess the role of skills more broadly would therefore be to compare incomes of rich and poor children, or black and white children, who attend the exact same college, majored in the same discipline, and performed equally well. This comparison has remained elusive because it requires very detailed data on large numbers of children. But in 2017, a team of economists made a good start by leveraging an astonishing new data set that we'll come back to repeatedly in this book. For the first time, they were able to compare outcomes of rich and poor kids attending the same exact colleges. Their results showed that at thousands of colleges around the country, attending the same college at age 19 cut the future income gap between rich and poor kids by about 80%. In other words, the careers of college classmates appeared to unfold on a playing field that was, miraculously, almost level. These findings about college, alongside those about test scores, suggest that skills provide the key bridge to economic security in today's American economy. This is clearly true for poor kids, and it's only somewhat less true for black kids and other racial minorities. And, as we'll see, despite the persistence of discrimination, skills play a larger role in explaining racial inequality than these numbers appear to suggest, because group skills operate differently from individual skills. It's hard to overstate the importance of skills in driving economic outcomes. If we could find a way to expand access to skill development resources, we would increase overall incomes dramatically, and we would largely eliminate the most pernicious aspects of inequality in America. Who builds skills? So who should be in charge of building all these valuable skills if not parents? The same kinds of people we put in charge of other complex tasks. Professionals. People such as teachers, tutors, counselors, coaches, nurses, and physicians, financed by the general public. But don't we already do that? Aren't I basically describing schools? Schools have teachers, counselors, coaches, and nurses. The parent trap thrives on the idea that schools are the primary skill builders. And it's true that the public schools we provide to all children do hire professionals to build skills, but they build only a small fraction of the skills we need children to develop. This is one of the great misunderstandings of our society. Look at it this way. Because skills are taught and learned rather than bought and sold, the primary raw ingredient in skill development is time. When we add up the total share of hours kids spend in formal public school, from conception to age 18, it turns out to be only 10% of childhood. How is that possible? Public school, the only education everyone gets for free, begins at age 5, operates only half of all days each year, and spans only one-third of all hours in each day. That's more time than kids used to get. About 150 years ago, kids spent 3% of their childhood in public school. But the current 10% still leaves an awful lot of skill building unaccounted for. Does it really matter that kids sleep outside of school? Should we count those hours as part of skill development? Absolutely. Kids who sleep better build more skills, and sleep quality varies dramatically by family environment. Noise, lack of privacy, heat, absence of safety, mold, smoke, air pollution, roaches, and rats remind us that inequality does not magically disappear at night. The remaining 90% of time outside of school is overseen, structured, and managed by parents. It is in this 90% of time that children must gain physical, social, emotional, and cognitive skills that schools have no choice but to shortchange during the scant instructional hours under their control. Time is the biggest ingredient in child skill development, but not the only one. There's also money. Public schools spend a lot on kids, but not nearly as much as parents do. In addition to direct expenditures, the time parents spend on children has enormous financial value. If we add up these investments, schools account for only 15% of spending on children. The real savage inequalities. If you think schools are where kids gain skills, it's natural to fixate on inequality in public school resources. And that's made a lot of sense. For most of American history, rich and white kids have attended schools with much greater resources than poor and minority kids. But if you're really worried about skill gaps among children today in America, you should be thinking way beyond inequality in K-12 public schools. You should be thinking about inequality in the families we require to do most of the skill building. Take a look at Table 0.1. This table combines a variety of data sources to look at resource gaps between rich and poor kids in two environments, schools and families. Start with the first row, which focuses on education spending. For schools, this is the gap in total budgets. For families, this is the gap in enrichment spending on things such as books, computers, tutoring, sports, and summer camps. The gap in per-pupil spending in public schools across rich and poor kids is 2%, meaning rich kids get about 2% more resources than poor kids when they're at school. The per-pupil spending gap across rich and poor kids at home is 1,576%. Huh? That's right. Rich kids get 15 times the enrichment spending of poor kids during that 90% of time they spend out of school. Take the second row. Rich and poor kids all learn from teachers with college degrees at school. But rich kids are 256% more likely to learn from teachers at home, parents with college degrees. The third row. Rich kids learn from teachers at home who score 150% higher on a common test of certain kinds of cognitive skills. The story goes on. At school, on average, rich and poor kids get identical instructional time, delivered in classes of equal size. At home, the kids of richer parents get 23% more instructional time on things such as help with homework, museum visits, and reading out loud. And rich kids get this extra time at home in 21% smaller classes due to their greater likelihood of living with two parents and fewer siblings. The story is similar for white and black children. Public K-12 school resource gaps today are non-existent or small compared to vast differences at home between racial groups. Many people find it shocking that poor and minority children in America today, on average, attend K-12 schools with similar funding. More than shocking, they find it implausible, and it's easy to see why. Many journalists eloquently describe jarring school resource gaps by race and class, and books like Savage Inequalities by Jonathan Kozol contrast the kinds of schools attended by rich and poor children in parts of the United States. In fact, although many examples of school resource gaps do exist and warrant concern, they do not represent the typical situation in American schools today. If that's true, why all the confusion? A few reasons. First, many of these comparisons ignore federal funding, which goes largely to schools serving poor children. This is like calculating personal income without counting tips or bonuses. It's not a complete picture. Once we combine federal, state, and local funding, school resource gaps vanish or even reverse. Another reason for the confusion is that old perceptions change slowly, and so it's difficult to see that things have gotten much more equal in America's schools. This didn't happen by accident. It resulted from monumental efforts made by legal and political activists. 100 years ago, there really were massive public school resource gaps by class and race. These days, however, state and federal spending play a larger role than local property tax revenue and distribute educational resources more progressively. The final reason for the confusion is that average school resource gaps capture only the typical situation. For any average, there will be many atypical situations that can be cherry-picked to confirm any preconceived notion. As an example, consider one influential article from the Washington Post entitled, "In 23 states, richer school districts get more local funding than poorer districts." Here, the author excludes federal funding from the calculation. She then focuses overtly on only 23 states. Here's an equally accurate alternative headline. In 27 states, poorer school districts get more local funding than richer districts. In fact, when we include federal aid, 42 states spent more on poor school districts than on rich school districts in 2012. The same pattern holds between schools within districts. Many still find these claims hard to believe. I must be twisting the numbers. So let's get more concrete. Let's examine some outlier school districts with very high and very low per-student spending in the United States. What's your guess for the highest spending districts? Maybe Princeton or Palo Alto? And what's your guess for the lowest spending districts? Maybe Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn or the south side of Chicago? Not quite. The highest spending districts are large urban centers such as New York City, Boston, and Baltimore. These cities spend large sums to educate rich and poor children alike. The lowest spending districts are harder to explain, but they're not poor inner-city neighborhoods. Many of them are in Utah. Why is that? Because Utah has a lot of Mormons, and Mormons have big families. Most education funding still comes from state and local sources. With more children per working adult, Utah schools make do with less funding per student. This funding gap may explain, in part, why Utah, a rich state, has performed at or below average in academic achievement. Cypress Fairbanks and Conroe are two very low-spending districts in Texas. These districts win awards for high academic achievement and serve families with above-average income for the state. Their low spending appears to reflect good management and low costs of living. Several of the lowest spending districts, such as Capistrano Unified School District, are in California, but these districts don't serve disproportionately poor or minority students. The main factor here is that California education spending overall is low due to decades of bad public policy mistakes. The image of low-income minority children sitting in large classes with badly paid teachers and no resources for books or field trips was accurate for most of American history. Today, that image is exceptional, not typical. Although more resources for schools serving poor kids would be useful, this goal should not distract parents from much larger solutions that will be required to close the current skills deficits between rich and poor kids. Inequality stems not from our public schools, but from our neglect of the primary skill builders hiding in plain sight, parents. When we put family gaps into perspective, we see that they dwarf K-12 school gaps. In fact, they surpass many of the K-12 school gaps that distinguished black and white segregated schools during the separate but equal farce under Jim Crow. Don't get me wrong, I'm not claiming that schools today are equal in all respects. Despite their similar access to funding, lower income and minority children still experience significant gaps in teacher experience, qualifications, and overall quality. These resource gaps do matter, but they are small in comparison to family gaps. If today's K-12...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?